And screen share. Here we go then. Well, welcome to part 8. And this is primarily about the inner journey. The Kabbalah version of Exodus says that this is our journey. It's absolutely our journey. And we don't know how much of the literal story is true. We don't know how much of it actually happened or whether it happened in the time frame that people think it happened. And oddly enough, that doesn't really matter, because it doesn't matter if it happened or it didn't happen. The story is true. The story is relevant and the story is superb. So let's start off with the idea that Moses and Pharaoh effectively are two sides of the same soul. They are the pride and the inability to allow things to change or to let go, and the person on the great journey of internal development and trying to bring the message back to their tribe. And they, of course, were related to each other. They were raised as brothers. So there's a lot of hurt and pain behind this story that we don't necessarily realise, in that two brothers are fighting again in the Bible. And if you remember, we've had Esau and Jacob, and we've had the sisters Leah and Rachel fighting. So there's so much that goes on within families, which is really important for us to understand, because you have to break away from the family on your spiritual journey. Now, unless you are exceedingly lucky and your family are soul companions with you on your work, which is quite rare, you have to leave your family, and that causes some ill feeling and some pain on both sides. So what we're seeing today is the growth of the soul. Moses represents the soul at the point of Tiferet leading into the soul, and the Israelites represent the lower parts of the psyche, which are still pulling back to the past, how very difficult it is for us to change. And if you've never thought about how difficult it is to change because you wanted to make changes, just try cleaning your teeth a different way every night for a week, in a different order, and see how your Yesod fights that. Because it won't like it, it'll be uncomfortable, and it will almost certainly make you forget to do it within 3 or 4 days. And this is a salutary lesson of how Yesod does not want to change. Because as far as it's concerned, its job is to keep us alive, and right now we're alive. So any change could possibly be threatening. Yesod only gives up and hands complete power to Tiferet when there's a huge crisis that it doesn't know how to deal with. Which doesn't mean Yesod is bad. The ego is not bad. It's essential. But it is like fire. It's a very good servant and a very bad master. So for all of us in this work, there came a point when we decided we were going to step up. There was a point at which we said, no, we have to do this, we have to move. But that's only the beginning, and you know as well as I am how many false starts there are on that journey. So God, and it's interesting that in Exodus, God shows up as Elohim and Yahweh shows up in different places. So it's quite interesting to work out whether this is because the text is edited or what. We've known that the name is Yahweh Elohim, but we're mixing and matching again. There isn't any official reason why. It's just interesting to note, because as a general rule, when it's Elohim, when it's God, it is part of the older text. And that's always valuable to see whether or not it was closer to the original. But Elohim did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, because that, even though that was shorter, he said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. And that's a valid point, because if you face violent opposition to what you want to do, you're most likely to be frightened and turn back. Now, the Israelites wanted to turn back anyway, but God was giving them the chance to go through the process in a way that was a lot less painful than going straight into battle. Once the Israelites got to the promised land and during the second part of their journey through the wilderness, there were battles, but they weren't battles to start with. It was more than enough that they had the crossing of the Red Sea, which we'll be coming to in a minute. So God led the people round by the desert road towards the Red Sea. And the Israelites went up out of Egypt armed for battle, which it doesn't actually mean armed, it means ready. They were certainly would have been working with cohorts. They would have been working with the men of youth around the edges because they were anticipating that there might be some form of attack. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him. They took an awful lot of stuff with them. Joseph had made the sons of Israel, the sons of Jacob, his father, swear that God will come to their aid and then you must carry my bones up with you from this place. So that's a prophecy that at one point they would need to leave Egypt. And psychologically, in Zev ben Shimon Halevi's view, Egypt does represent the land of bondage. It represents Yesod. We have to leave Egypt. Sometimes we come across folk who are very Egyptologists, mystical Egyptians, and they take great exception to that. But in this context, Egypt is the place of captivity. So the Israelites leave and they're setting out, 6,000 of them, that's a lot of people. And the Lord, this isn't God, this is the Lord, went before them by day in a pillar of cloud, lovely picture on the left then, and by night as a pillar of fire. So they had light and they knew where they were going. And if we look at the tree of life on the right hand side, the column, both the fire, pillar of fire, and the pillar of cloud represent the central column of the tree of life, which is marked out there in red. And the central column from Malkut Yesod to Ferit to, I've got Christ there, but it's Keter. It's the Christ consciousness, not Jesus Christ. But this is the point we have to hold to when we can. We will get pulled to either side. We'll get pulled to the left-hand side, which is our pain and our addiction to pain, and on the right-hand side, which is our addiction to pleasure. And of course, when we set out on a great adventure like this, it starts as pleasure, it's huge excitement, very netzach, very hesed. But then after a while, it sort of swings round to gevurah and hod because the consequences of our actions may be painful. So the Israelites start whining almost immediately. I put whining in the feeling triad on the tree of life here on the right hand side. Feeling triad is between thought, action and ego, and it's how our short-term feelings, as in we feel bad today, they're not the deep emotions. Those are in the pain and pleasure side triads. They're the momentary ones or the ones in one day. You may wake up feeling depressed, but by the end of the day, you're okay. That's that triad. It's not the deep, deep stuff. And most of it is caused by external aspects of your life. You may feel good because you won some money on the lottery. You may feel bad because you lost some money or a bill came in that was too big. But it's not like losing a partner or a great emotional event, which is going to build on so many things in the past. It's a passing thing. And in the triad between thought, ego and body, hod, yesod, malkut, I put blame because that's very prevalent for that triad. That triad is the thinking triad, and it's all about what you're going over and over and over again in your mind, the patterns of thought that you have. And that triad is not active, it's passive. And blame tends to be a very passive thing because it's the other person's fault and I am helpless in this. And on the other side, we've got threats. That's the active triad, which is about what you want to do and how you act out your ego, your netzach, which is action, and your body. So I put threats in there because the Israelites were put a few threats around as well. And that's when you become the bully when you want to change things. So whining, blame and threats are the negative aspects around the ego. And the armed forces of Egypt are starting to pursue the Israelites already because Pharaoh, God bless him, has changed his mind again. As soon as they've gone, presumably, you know, he let them go because of such a tragedy as the firstborn. But then after a day or so, everybody sort of goes, well, hang on a minute, we've lost our workforce. Hang along a minute, we've lost this. What if they're going to join in with our enemies? What if they're going to come back and fight us? So he sends his army after them. Some stories says he went with the army, but he didn't die if that was the case. Other stories say he sent his generals. And the Egyptians are thundering along behind. The Israelites see in the distance the dust cloud that's being raised by the horses' hooves. And they start whining to Moses, were there no graves in Egypt that you brought us here to die in the wilderness? And that's a fabulous way of putting it, because if you know Jewish folk well, you know that they're very good at answering a question with a question. And Jewish folk often speak in questions. And it just has such a lovely Hebrew aspect to it. Were there no graves in Egypt that you brought us here to die in the wilderness? I can hear my mother-in-law saying it, absolutely. And Moses goes and whines to God, well, or the Lord, which of course one would in the circumstances. And the Lord comes back and says, why are you crying out to me? Speak to the children that they go forward, lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. They're camping on the edge of the sea. We'll get to which sea in a minute. And they feel like they're trapped. But that's the trouble with the ego, is it feels that it's trapped. And the ego, if it's in charge, cannot see any new idea. It will only go around memory and what it's learnt from, say, stuff on the internet or books it's read. It can't come up with anything new. It's the true self in the centre of the tree, which has action to consciousness and free will. And that's the part of us that will deal with any brand new situation or threat. We leap into Tiferet if there's a threat. Yesod will then back it up by saying, I have this information for you. But it will leave the true self to act on its own behalf. And that's why for spiritual folk, training ourselves to become the watcher, to look at ourselves, to look at our psyches, to understand ourselves and go, oh, here I am again, eating another bar of chocolate, even though I know it's not good for me. Okay, what do I do about this? Do I consciously eat it with absolute joy? That's a better way than eating it, than sitting at my computer scoffing it. Or do I use the discipline of Gevurah to say, I don't need that extra chocolate? That's just a very trite example, but it shows how important it is to be able to get to Tiferet in the smallest situations, because otherwise we can slip so easily into those side trials of pain and pleasure. The addictions to both of those are very powerful in the world today. So the Lord says to Moses, do something new, do something dramatic. Lift up your rod and stretch your hand over the sea and divide it, which of course is clearly impossible. However, when you're at Tiferet, things are not impossible. As mentioning on the Tuesday group, there are true stories of people who've lifted up calves to get children out from underneath them. And the spiritual teacher, Jack Canfield, I'm sure he's still around, I haven't heard of him for a long, long time, but he actually went on a pilgrimage to meet a woman who'd lifted a car up off a child, which had been knocked down. And she literally lifted it up while other people pulled the child out. But she never talked about it. People spread the story around, but she didn't talk about it. She didn't go on Oprah. Well, Oprah wasn't around then. She didn't make a big fuss about it. She didn't talk about it. And when Jack went to see her, he found out that she was actually quite traumatized by it, because she said the fact that she was able to do such an extraordinary thing frightened her. And she went into a kind of a decline, because she thought of all the other things that she should have done but never had done. And she started beating herself up by the fact that she had this power, but she'd never used it. And of course, that was a wonderful trap by Yesod to pull her back down into being ordinary again, because she'd become extraordinary. And she didn't like the attention that gave her. And she said to Jack Canfield that she had always wanted to do a college degree. She'd never done one, but she was in her 80s by then. And Jack said a very wise thing to her. He said, well, you have two choices. You can live another 3 years and still not have your college degree and have the regrets, or you can go to college and in 3 years' time you will have a degree. It's completely up to you. But he said it in such a simple way that she was inspired by it, and she went to college and she lived long enough to get her degree. So it's fascinating how Yesod will try so hard to pull us back so we're not extraordinary. And that's because the tall poppy is the one that gets cut down by society and the ego. The famous people who we put up on pedestals pretty soon get knocked down off them. Now, the Red Sea or the Reed Sea. Now, we can get caught up in this in Hod for hours. I'm going to spend about 5 minutes on it because it's very interesting to just to show us what we know and what we don't know. And the simple answer to which sea was it they crossed is we don't know. The Reed Sea is this lake at the top where my cursor is pointing now on the map on slide number 6. Right at the top of the Red Sea on the left-hand side, you can see there's a big lake there, and that's the Reed Sea. And below it is the great big Gulf of Eilat, or the Red Sea. And Bernard F. Basso, who's a professor of religious studies and a writer in the Biblical Archaeological Review, which actually is a fascinating magazine, I love it, I've quoted him there. And he has said that, no, the new theory that it's the Reed Sea is not so. But I'm going to read you a couple of essays, very, very short ones by two people with opposing views, and it's completely up to you what you think. Now, a chap called Carl Drews was the one who came up with the idea it was the Reed Sea, not the Red Sea. And it's incredibly logical and rational. It makes perfect sense. But we have to be aware that he's a software engineer. He's not a Bible scholar of Hebrew. He says that it was the Lake of Tanis, which is that top lake pictured. He said, so if you want to find a sea of reeds today, that's it. It was the ideal place for papyrus reeds to grow, a shallow, brackish lagoon. And he says that it's a real historical occurrence because at the Reed Sea, at this lake, there is a specimen of wind. There's the meteorology and the oceanography, and quite frequently a wind will go through that sea, and because it's shallow and it's brackish, so it is a sea, it parts the reeds, so it creates a passageway to go through. And the miracle, as Bill pointed out to me on Tuesday, was the timing of that. That when they got there at that point, that was the timing at which the reeds parted and they were able to go through. And that makes total logical sense to me. However, Bernard Basso says that it isn't that way because the Hebrew is Yam Suf. And it appears many times in the Hebrew Testament. And in most of those influences, it does clearly refer to the Red Sea, including its two northern fingers, the Gulf of Suez and the Gulf of Eilat or Aqaba. And he says, note that I do not say that Yam Suf literally means Red Sea. What Yam Suf means is part of the problem. Yam is indeed sea, that much is clear and agreed. But for the word for red is Adam, not Suf. Literally, Red Sea should be Yam Adam, not Yam Suf. Yet from the context, we know that in a number of biblical references, Yam Suf refers to the body of water that we do know as the Red Sea. 1 Kings 9:26 is an example. King Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion Geber near Eilat on the shore of the Yam Suf in the land of Edom. And from the other geographical references, it's absolutely clear that Yam Suf refers to the northeastern finger of the Red Sea, known today as the Gulf of Eilat or the Gulf of Aqaba. But you know something? Pick whichever you like, because ultimately it doesn't matter. It's the story that matters, that the Holy One, in whatever way, created a miracle because the people stood at Tiferet. And once you're at Tiferet, through art, miracles are almost commonplace. So now we have a very complicated diagram on the left-hand side. That's Deb Ben-Shemon Halevi's primary diagram of the psyche. So the body is at the bottom, the ego or the shadow. We all have a shadow aspect to our psyche, which we tend to hide from ourselves, from other people. And then above, beyond that shadow, up through the liminal threshold, we get to Tiferet, which is the place of the self. And you can see that the individual unconscious is in these side triads here. And conscience and consciousness comes at Tiferet and above. So what the Hebrews are doing, or what we have to do, is we have to rise out, well, we don't have to, but we're on this journey to do it, rise out of the triangle between Hod, Netzach and Malkut, which is ruled by Yesod, and rightly so, because Yesod is the voice of the body. We have to go across the liminal threshold, which is the first point of waking up towards a form of consciousness. And this triad is known as the awakening triad, and it's also known the triad as my will. This is the level of us where we find out who we actually are, as opposed to who we think we are. For example, you think you're going to learn to run 5K and you think you can do it, and you try it and you find it's an awful lot harder than you think it is. And there you've got to get to Tiferet and make the decision from Gevurah whether you're going to persevere or whether you're going to give up and get back to the person you always thought you were secretly, which was somebody who wasn't going to get that fit. And then you can get into resentment and blame about it, because obviously it's not your fault. So when you get to this awakening triad, you are being asked to make a commitment to step away from the ego, away from the tribe. And that's what the crossing of the Red Sea reflects, because there is no way back. And once you've experienced Tiferet, got through the awakening triad to becoming the watcher of your own psyche. And by the way, once you're the watcher, doesn't mean to say you've got virtue, because going back to the analogy of chocolate, you will watch yourself after you've eaten the chocolate. And then the next time you'll watch yourself while you're eating the chocolate, but you will still eat the chocolate. And then another time you'll watch yourself while you're eating the chocolate, and then you'll stop eating the chocolate, put it back in the cupboard, and then an hour later, because you feel upset because you had a bad phone call or email, yes, or we'll walk you to the cupboard and eat it, and watch you, you'll watch yourself while you do it. But it's a slow and steady process of watching yourself. It's your consciousness watching your automatic reactions. So crossing the Red Sea was shutting the door on the past. For us, it would be representative of leaving our family, or leaving our job, or leaving maybe the Reiki group we're in because it's become toxic, or the support group we're in. It's about having the courage to stand up as an individual without blame and walking, just saying, not this. And that's what's so frightening about it, because all you can say at that point is, not this. Usually you don't know where you're going, as the Israelites were. They just didn't want to be where they were. And that is the great spiritual challenge for the spiritual seeker, which is to say, not this, and to trust that if you walk, God will provide the next step. And God always does provide the next step, but not until you walk. Not until you take that absolute step of commitment that says, I will do this. And I gave you the analogy of couch to 5K, because I started doing that myself in November, because I'd realized that I simply couldn't run anymore. I had to run after one of the beagles because she got away, and I couldn't do it. I simply couldn't do it. She's having a clatter in the corner, just to illustrate this. And it was quite shocking to me, because I hadn't tried to run for a very long time. So I didn't realise how, not only how unfit I was, but how weak my body was. Now, I had been very ill a few years ago, but I thought I was building back strength, but obviously not. So I did make the commitment to do this couch to 5K. Now, for most people, it takes about 8 weeks, and it took me 6 months. And I still can't manage the 5K every time without slowing into a walk, but I'm getting there. But my goodness, I can't tell you how much commitment that took you. I do it 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday and Friday. And I can guarantee to you, every Monday, every Wednesday, every Friday, I still wake up not wanting to do it. And my Yesod will do everything it can to say, well, you can't really do it today, even now. But fortunately, once you've got to the stage I'm at, Yesod is just beginning to turn. It's going to give you all the excuses not to, but it's also got in the habit of doing it. So if it wins and gets me not to do it, it feels bad about it. So I'm actually at a kind of pivot point with Yesod in then probably about another 6 weeks as I persevere, and I will, it's going to start pushing me to do it. And that's how Yesod gets to be a wonderful servant. It's the same with meditation. When you start meditating, Yesod won't want you to do it because you're trying to let go of control. You're trying to contact the higher worlds, and Yesod is going to go, oh no, dangerous, dangerous, dangerous. But if you meditate every day for a full 6 weeks, by the end of those, you will have trained your Yesod, and it will start nagging you if you don't meditate. So you might just as well use it for the good, but it does take effort. Now, I was going to quote that quotation that is always attributed to Goethe. Until one is committed, there's hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there's one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans, that the moment one definitely commits oneself, then the universe moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one who would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favour all manner of unforeseen incidents, meetings, and material assistance, which no man could have dreamt would have come his way. And then the final sentence, which everybody quotes, is, whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Begin it now. Okay, it wasn't written by Goethe. Sorry about that. It was written by a chap called William Hutchinson Murray, 1913 to 1996. At least that last couplet was. And most of the rest of it is an adaptation by Hutchinson Murray, because it's a loose translation of a quotation from Goethe's Faust. But it doesn't, again, it doesn't matter who said it. It's so true. It's a very, very powerful quotation. So Moses raises his staff, the Red Sea parts, and they go through the Red Sea. And they get to the other side just as the Egyptians start racing into the sea, and the sea falls back on them and kills them. Now, if it were the Reed Sea, that means that the water flowed back because the wind stopped and all the horses' hooves got tangled up in the reeds, and that would make them fall over. And a falling over horse drowning in reeds, that's going to have exactly the same effect. And at the end of this, once they're out, there's a famous little bit in the Bible about Miriam, the sister of Aaron and Moses, took a timbrel, that's a tambourine, and the women went out with her with timbrels and with dances, and they sang, sing to the Lord, for his triumph gloriously, the horse and the rider has he thrown into the sea. Now, two things there. Firstly, she's called Miriam the prophetess. Actually, it doesn't mean prophetess, it means, I can't remember what it means now. How utterly embarrassing. I'll have to remind you next week. It doesn't mean that she tells prophecies, it means something else equally good, but I was stupid enough not to make a note about it, so I'll try and make a note about that. Sorry, hanging prophetess. Anyway, and Midrash has an interesting thing there, which follows along another quotation, which also is not original, which is the one credited to Martin Luther King. And that is the quotation that says, where was it? About, I will mourn the loss of thousands of precious lives, but I will not rejoice in the death of one, not even an enemy. And that's attributed to Martin Luther King, but he didn't actually say it. He did, however, say, returning hate for hate multiplies hate, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. So we do have to worry a little bit when our opposition is vanquished that we don't gloat. Now, Miriam isn't gloating. She's celebrating. She's going, my God, we're saved. But Midrash, which is one of the commentaries, has a very interesting point here. It says, as the Egyptians were drowning, at the same time the angels wanted to sing before God and the Lord. God said to them, my creations are drowning and you are singing before me. Now that's a lovely comment because A, God and the Lord, so they're acknowledging God as the creatrix of the universe and the Lord as the God of Lord of humanity. And the two of them together are being acknowledged separately. And the Midrash says that it was fine for the humans to celebrate because their lives had been saved, but the angels should know better, that God would never celebrate the death of any of his creation through violence. So, on they go, trotting into the wilderness. 3 days in the wilderness, no water. Well, that's pretty serious. And guess what? They started murmuring. They started complaining about Moses. It's the same old thing. Well, why didn't you leave us back in Egypt? We're going to die here. We might just as well have died back in Egypt. And that's good old Yesod going, this isn't going the way we thought it was. This isn't my first foray into comedy and I haven't won Britain's Got Talent yet, basically. This isn't happening. And then we get this idea of coming out of this whining into the battle. And this is the battle for our true self. This is the battle that we have to fight to stand up and to trust. And it is a battle. So Moses cries to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. And Moses pulls up the tree and casts it into the water. And the water was, there was water there, but it was bitter water. It was salt water. They couldn't drink it. It was marsh water. And the tree turned the water sweet. And this is interesting because we usually view the tree of life with Keter, the crown, we'd think it would be the branches, the flowers of the tree. And of course, when the menorah is depicted as an almond tree, all the knops and the lumps and bumps on the menorah are said to be aspects of the almond tree, and the root is at Malkut and the branches spread out. But there are many cultures that say the great tree, the world tree, is actually upside down, and the roots are in heaven and the fruits are down on earth. And that makes a lot of sense in many ways, because the roots of who we are, the roots of our karma, why we've come down in this life, and also the trunk of the tree, which is what we're consciously doing with this life, are going to become the fruits of this life. So the upside down tree is a lovely metaphor which we can use quite frequently. So they've now got water, so that's good, and they keep on journeying, and they go into the wilderness between Elim and Sinai, and now they're hungry. And guess what they say? Would to God we died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Jesus, in land of Egypt, where we sat by the flesh pots, when we ate bread to the full, for you've brought us to this wilderness to kill us with hunger. And then said the Lord to Moses, I will rain lechem, it's translated as bread, from heaven for you, and the people should go out and gather a certain rate every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. Whenever it says prove in the Hebrew Testament, it means test. It's from the old root of the word in both Hebrew, Greek and Latin, which is to prove something. Well, you know the phrase, I've got to prove something. It means to test it, to see if it's actually true. We prove things with the scientific method now. So the Lord has said, okay, fair enough, you need food. I will provide this food. And they called it manna. Manna is the Hebrew word for what is it? It doesn't mean bread at all. It means what is it? And all the texts, the commentaries say that the food that came from heaven was milk for the babies, meat for the people, bread for the elderly, and gruel for the very elderly. So basically, you got what food you needed. So this is physical miracles, but it's also psychological and spiritual, as in the Lord will give you the food that you need at any level. You will be provided with the learning you need, the experiences you need, and the food that you need. You might not like it, but it will feed you. Oh, let's do a quick aside here about Miriam and the water. There's a phrase in Numbers here, and that's that beautiful picture by Yoram Ronan, that says that when Miriam died and was buried, this is towards the end of the Exodus, the congregation had no water, and they started moaning against Moses and Aaron again. And from that, a lot of the commentaries say that they had water the whole time that Miriam was there. Well, that's sort of contradicting what we just read. However, it's a sign of the e-text still in this story. A lot of people who promote the e-text, the Elohim text, think that the Moses text is supersedes it and overrules it. But I think they are still blending. These are still two very valid terminologies of the same story. So Miriam's well is the name of the spring that legend says miraculously provided water and accompanied the Israelites throughout the 40 years they travelled in the wilderness. And 40, of course, Jesus had 40 days in the wilderness. Moses later is going to have 40 days up with God on Sinai. And 40 represents 4 times 10 sephirot of the tree of life. So it means a complete transformation at all levels. 40 years is symbolically necessary, physically, for the generation that left Egypt all to die off. So it's their children that go to the promised land. And that represents new thinking, new life force. And if you're thinking, well, people can survive more than 40 years, indeed they can nowadays. But in biblical times, the average lifespan of a man was 40 years and the average lifespan of a woman was 27 years. The woman's average is much, much lower because so many women died in childbirth. Very little contraception in those days. The best they had was soaking sheep's wool in a form of vinegar. And they did have a kind of a form of condom. But given that the commandment was to go forth and multiply, not a lot of people used that. And a lot of the women died very young in childbirth because they didn't have the medical services that we have today. So a woman could not necessarily expect to live even up to 40 years. And they will have been babes in arms that left Egypt, and they may well have seen the promised land, but as they were babes in arms, their yesod wasn't fully formed by then. So back to the manna. The manna falls from heaven and it comes with God's instructions, which says you'll get fresh every day for 6 days. And on the sixth day, gather twice as much as you need because you won't get any dropping on the Sabbath. You've got to keep some for the Sabbath. And if you follow that rule, the bread or the food for the Sabbath will stay good. There will be none on the Sabbath. And Moses said, channeling God, don't leave any of it till the morning. But of course, we don't trust. We get a gift from God enough to keep us going and we squirrel some of it away for the rainy day. We say, well, we can't trust that it's going to turn up tomorrow. I mean, we do this all the time. We've got freezers full of food and we've got cans of stuff in the cupboard and it probably doesn't matter so much for us. And that's the way society is now. But the lesson is very clearly trust God every day to supply you with what you need and the terms on which you can keep it healthy. And of course, they didn't listen to Moses. Who would? Some of them left some of the manna till the morning and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was furious with them. Now, Moses is dealing with an unruly rabble of people, some of whom genuinely want to be there and some of whom thought it was just going to be a fun adventure. And some of them are still wishing they were back in Egypt. And these represent our lower psyche and Moses' own lower psyche, because Moses appears strong and wise in this journey. But of course, he's got all his doubts and everything going on as well, because he's exactly human. And this is why we need what we might seem as petty rules and all the 613 laws of the Hebrew Testament, made to us nowadays seem like they're petty, but they were needed for a desert tribe. They lived a very different life in those days. Now, you may disagree with Orthodox Jewish folk who attempt to keep all of them, but I'm with St. Paul along the lines of the fact that you can't keep all the laws. It's utterly impossible to keep all the laws. And the reason you can't keep them is to give you humility to know that you're not perfect. And the psyche is a very loosely bound complex of levels and units. And if it's undisciplined and doesn't learn about the petty rules, if you like, as a child at Yesod, it won't learn how to grow up to be a successful adult. We had to learn all sorts of things like don't put your hand in the fire, look left and right, or right and left if you're in another country, before you cross the road. Don't poke a snake, don't pet a dog that's snarling at you. All these things that to us seem quite logical now had to be taught to us as children. So laws are essential. As you rise up to the higher realms, you find that fewer of them apply, because you are operating in the way that Jesus taught us specifically, though he's quoting Leviticus and Deuteronomy: love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul and all thy strength and all thy might, and thy neighbour as thyself. Nothing is more important than these two, and they actually cover pretty much everything else of the rules. So that weird diagram with what looks like the green and purple butterfly there is talking about how even when we try to get up the tree, those side triads, the intellectual ones, which are purple, those are our morals and our ethics and our beliefs and our prejudices, and the green ones are our emotions. If we don't get clear rules, clear, sensible, good, grounding rules, these will swell up in search of some form of rule, because the psyche has to know its boundaries, has to know the boundaries of the tribe, it has to know the boundaries of its own strength. And if it's been taught bad boundaries or bad tribal aspects or no boundaries, then it will seek any form of fundamentalism. One of the reasons why fundamentalism is on the rise in the world is because of a couple of generations of parents being much less disciplinary with their children and children running riot. I don't have children, I can't comment on this, but I've read quite a few wise people who've plotted the fact that children of families who are very bohemian and have no rules or regulations as a child, the children quite frequently when they grow up go into some form of fundamentalism because they need boundaries. They don't have them, they don't feel safe. They don't want to individuate, they want to join a tribe that will tell them what is safe to do. So if you haven't learnt boundaries as a child, you're going to find it very difficult to apply boundaries to yourself, and you're going to need outside rule. And let's face it, these Hebrews were pretty undisciplined. So here we go again. They're pottering on and there was no water. They're getting their manna, but they're getting no water. So this is directly contradicting the Miriam story. And I can't offer you anything there. Really, from the juxtaposition of Miriam and the water shortages, the sages of the Talmud believed that they had got the water source, but they weren't necessarily able to see it. And Miriam was connected to water. Well, she stood by the waters of the Nile to watch over her baby brother when her mother put it in. And since she was so grateful for the miracle of the Red Sea, God rewarded her with water, for which the Jewish people sang even more praise. But I suspect we can meld these together, but it's just my theory, that there is always water to drink, but how we pollute that water matters. I mean, for example, we live in a house which has got main supply water, but for the last 10 years we lived in a house which had the water from underneath the house. It had groundwater. We had a little artesian well that brought up all our water, and it went through a filtering system and straight out of the tap. And that meant that anything that went in the bath or down the lavatory went into the septic tank, which then seeped down into the water we would drink. And that meant we did not use anything like Roundup or any poisons. We didn't use bleach. It was much easier using bleach in the previous home, but you didn't use it because it would poison your water. So it's quite possible, but it's only my supposition, that because of Miriam there always was water, but the thoughts of the psyche can poison that water. So now we get to Sinai, Mount Sinai, the place said to be where the law was given. So they get to this holy mountain, and Moses is called up to God, and the Lord called unto him out of the mountain. Remember, Yahweh is the one who appears to have the direct relationship with humanity. God appears to have the direct relationship with all creation, but Yahweh appears to be more one-to-one, as it were. So the Lord calls to Moses and say, this you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the children of Israel. You've seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. So what is the message is here is I'm lifting you up to the spiritual world of Berea. And Berea intersects Yetzirah, the world of the psyche. So that's bringing clear air down into the water of Yetzirah. And Moses spoke and God answered him by a voice. Well, that sounds really weird, but let's have a look at this. On this first ascent, with the external and the internal, because Moses is doing an internal ascent to communicate with the Holy One. And the five senses, five basic senses, there's intuition as well, of course. Touch is generally ruled by the physical body, so it would be right down at the base of Yetzirah in the center of Asiya, because touch is always physical. You feel it. Taste is the upper level of Asiya and the lower face of Yetzirah, because you taste something that's mostly physical, but it's in water. Your mouth is always filled with saliva and water, and without your saliva, it's much more difficult to taste things. They're just dry. So taste works at that level. Scent is in the top triangle here of Yetzirah because it's air and water. Scent is carried in the water particles that are in the air. Sound is usually this one at the higher end of Berea, because sound comes through the air. Now, of course, the air has water in it, but sound is very different underwater from the way it is in air. Good, clear sound needs to be in air. And sight requires on light, which is fire at the top of Atzilut. So that's how those four aspects of us fit on the tree. And in this Exodus story, as Moses goes up, there's an earthquake, this which would represent touch. There's smoke, which, yes, that can be air, but it's also taste. You taste it. When it comes in through your nose, it's acrid. You get the taste of it. And then in sound, there's trumpet, thunder, and the voice. And then the lightning represents the lightning flash itself coming down from the Holy One. So Moses has got to what we would call Keter, or the kingdom of God. He's come to the base of Atzilut and the crown of Yetzirah. And because he's at this level, we know that it is primarily internal. This is being done in what's known as a Merkaba meditation. Moses is going inside himself to communicate with the Holy One. Now, we're going to get to the Ten Commandments as set in stone next week, but they are given to Moses. We don't know exactly what is given here, because it is just said that the Lord dispenses the law to him. So let's assume Ten Commandments, although all the mystics say that these were the advisements, these were the guidelines of how to live carefully. But if you look at the commandments themselves, you'll see that they were given in sound, but they're also divided up. The top three are about our relationship with the divine. Then the middle three are about the relationship of our soul, how we relate to ourself and the aspects of ourself that help us to live in harmony with other people. Honor your father and mother doesn't just mean your physical father and mother. It means your heritage. It means understand where you come from. Because where you come from has formed you, and it is part of your heritage, and understanding it will help you understand your reactions to everything. And to sanctify the Sabbath, my God, if only we would do this nowadays. We live in this world of constant entertainment, constant stimulation, constant viewing and listening and reading and moving and working and driving. And the Sabbath is the only way to calm us down, to allow us to take the journey out of Yesod. That's why so often it's a serious illness or an accident or some horrible aspect that happens to us, which is what lifts us out, because it makes us stop. And if we won't stop, we won't be listening. And do not murder. Well, of course, that is a capital crime. I'm not saying you should be killed in doing it, but the phrase a capital crime is very valid. To murder, to destroy somebody else's dreams or life, is karmically hugely reprehensible. And to destroy somebody's dreams is just as reprehensible. To say that's a stupid idea is a form of murder. But even more important is, do not murder yourself. Do not stop yourself from getting here. Do not deny yourself the time, the sense, the honour that you deserve to accept your true self. Honour your dreams, follow your dreams, take the risks, step out. Because to live in Yesod all your life is to murder your life. It means nothing new can come of it. Nothing can be learnt, nothing can grow. So not to get to that level is a form of self-murder. And the bottom four are clearly our relationship with the world. And they're all the relationship with the world, but they do fit nicely into these categories. When we adulterate, that means to poison. To adulterate something is to add poison to it. So it doesn't necessarily just refer to sexual relationships. It means anything that you're working on or with or doing that has something added to it that damages it is adulterous. And it's quite often something's going really well at the office and a new person comes in and it just doesn't work and it's adulterous. A new person may come in and it becomes even better. But when adultery is there, things spoil. Don't steal. That's to steal ideas, thoughts, emotions. And also, one of my colleagues, Michael Hatwick, put this beautifully. He said, to steal is to treat somebody or something as a thing. You steal their humanity or their animism. And do not bear false witness. Well, that's don't tell fibs, obviously. Don't gossip. Don't build things up to be better than they are. Nearly all of marketing is false witness. You do this, you'll feel better. Yeah, briefly. And do not covet, which is the commandment that all the others fit into. To covet means to want what is not right now yours. And as soon as you want something that somebody else has got and put your attention on that, you cease appreciating what you've got. It's perfectly all right to look at something somebody else has got and say, I aspire to the version of that which would be perfect for me. That's different. But to go, they've got this, I want this, it's not fair, they've got this, that is envy and that is dangerous. Right. The Book of the Covenant, which is basically the laws that come out in Exodus, and we will talk more about those, but I think it's relevant to mention them there, is basically law of cause and effect, which basically means if you do this, that will happen. Most of them are directives of justice and mercy, and the ones that aren't are edited in. Warren Kent and Zeb Ben Shimon Halevi did a lot of work on this and looked at some scholarly work as well about the way people write, because every author, everyone who writes something down, uses a certain vocabulary, which is why an author really needs an editor, because an editor has a different vocabulary and will spot when the author is being repetitious or boring and will put a different word in that means something slightly different. So you can tell when a text has been edited, and just a little bit of a text is edited, because it just reads differently. But the majority of these are simplicity, directness and spirituality of worship, a high and equitable standard of right, highest consideration for the weak and the poor, the humane treatment of dumb animals, purity in the relations of life, the spirit of brotherhood, and the simple and joyful life. Whatever development in details came with later legislation did not nullify the simple but lofty standards of the earlier laws. And I think that's beautifully put. So let's have a look at some of these laws that came down. We don't know which ones came down where. We only know primarily that the Ten Commandments came from up on high. But we also know that there were several journeys. There were three journeys up there. So look at these laws here. They're very, very good. Don't vex a stranger or oppress him. Money lent to the poor should not be used to oppress them or hold over them. Don't follow the multitude that do wrong things. And that's so easy to do, isn't it? To follow the ebb and flow of fashion. Don't corrupt justice for someone who's poor but wrong. Because sometimes we can be over kind to somebody who's poor and say, okay, fair enough, I'll allow you that. But when it's a case of not being just, probably not. That's a tricky one, but it's interesting. If a man remarries, he mustn't deprive his first wife of food, clothing, and marital rights. Marital rights would mean her home or something like that, not sex. But certainly that's a very sound law. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and hand for a hand, foot for a foot. That is actually the value of an eye. It doesn't necessarily say if somebody accidentally blinds you, you go and poke his eye out. You have some form of compensation that will compensate you for the loss of your eye. It can mean literally, but it was far more interpreted to be the value of that loss. When you give testimony, speak the truth. Well, yes. If a man steals land from another man for food, he shall make retribution with the best of his own field. Help a stranger who has a fallen animal. And the laws about women, yes, we find them difficult, but they are totally conversant with the view of the value that women had at the time. And unfortunately, the case with all systems which are primarily patriarchal, and by the time this was written down, the Hebrew Bible, it was primarily patriarchal, women were treated the same way by women as they were by men. And I'm really sorry I forgot to pause, didn't I? Never mind, we'll keep going for the moment. So Moses goes up this first time, and we are assuming that he got all these dictates and the Ten Commandments, all the Ten Advisements. It does not make that clear. But he came down, told the people the words of the law and the judgments, and the people answered with their own voice and said, all the words which the Lord has said, we will do. Because it's so easy to do that. But they said they would. Then Moses is invited to go up a second time, and to take up his brother and Aaron's two sons, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. So 70 is a significant number, which is said to be the number of wise men or assistants to the great ones of the time. So they're going up together. And this is because Moses goes up and gets the direct communication with the Lord. And then the others go up, and it's fairly clear from the text and the commentaries that although they experience the Holy One, it is Moses who teaches them, because they're not at the level of Moses that they can hear exactly what the Holy One is trying to tell them. But they go into that rarefied atmosphere to lift themselves up. It's a bit like if you've ever seen somebody in person like Eckhart Tolle, who's one of the great teachers of the world now, a great prophet, if you sit in his presence, and I've been very lucky in that I went to see him at a time when he was so popular, there was no place for me to sit but at his feet, and he allowed me to sit at his feet, you could feel the power of his guidance, of God coming through that man. I could only hear his words, but I could feel that the power was coming through them. So this is about the second ascent. The people can hear God's words and experience God's spirit through Moses on this second ascent. But they've gone up for this experience because they will have to be the ones that moderate the Israelites in these teachings that they have already agreed to fulfill. But of course, everybody knows they won't because they're like us. Now, they go up on the right-hand side here. There's this diagram of Jacob's ladder with the heavens in it. And I sent you the meditation of the seven heavens at the start of the Exodus course. So you can refer back to that or look at this diagram as you like. But the heavens are at different levels. Now, it says that Aaron, Nadab, Abihu and the 70 of the elders saw the God of Israel. Well, they didn't see God's face, but they were up here in the fourth heaven where they had the possibility of seeing the glory, that the aspect of the Holy One which can be revealed. They wouldn't have seen God, but they would have seen the glory of God. They'd have seen the gateway, the doorway. It would have been like a door opening so that they could see that the Holy One was beyond it. So that's what it kind of means, that they saw the God of Israel. It doesn't mean actually that they were face to face, because nobody was at that time. Even Moses isn't allowed to see the Holy One's face at that point, even though some of the commentaries say he was in regular discussion with God and did see his face. But I think generally the view is that the presence of the whole of the Holy One would just burn you to a shred. So you get as much of it as you can bear. So these people are up at the fourth heaven, and the Lord says to Moses, come up to me into the mount. So that's deeper inside, and I will give you tablets of precious stone, and this is the sapphires, and an instruction and commandments which I have written, and you may teach. So basically, the Lord has said to the Lord or God has said to Moses, these are what I want you to tell them, and he goes down and tells them. And then Moses go back up, and the Lord sort of reaffirms it. And if you're anything like me, just because somebody's told you something does not mean to say you're going to remember it all clearly. So they're going to go back and get the mystical commandments on tablets of sapphire, which are transparent. And that means that they are flowing, they are movable, not so much movable, but they are not set in a kind of stone that means thou shalt and thou shalt not, is what we get later. They are, this is the way things work. If you look through this glass, this is what you will see, this is what you will experience, and this is what you will receive. And there you are, it says the glory of the Lord lived upon Mount Sinai. That's what the people saw. And the cloud covered it 6 days, which meant that the people below that level couldn't see it. And the seventh day, the Lord called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud, and Moses was in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. That 40 again. So it may well not have been 40 days and 40 nights, but it is the significance of the fact that he was completely cleansed during that experience. So Merkabah, which is the internal chariot workings or meditation of Kabbalah, has this paradox of God being seen and unseen. So it's perceived, but not necessarily seen with the physical eyes. You see God with the third eye. You perceive that. And the Holy One will reveal itself to all of us through that level of perception. So that's what the people below the cloud were experiencing, those 70 who went up there. And the book of Ezekiel places the image of the likeness of the glory of the Lord in the story of Ezekiel's vision. So this is the four worlds. We've got the image, which is Yetzirah, and he Ezekiel is seeing, he's the physical, he sees the image, Yetzirah, the likeness. We will make humanity in our own image, like us, of Berea, and the glory, which is at the base of Atzilut. And when Ezekiel saw that, he fell on his face and heard a voice of one who spoke. So he was given a picture, a perception in his meditation, but he could hear the voice inside his head as well. So the Holy One is not manifest. We are manifest. The Holy One manifests through creation. And we see basically the transcendent, invisible face of divinity can manifest as a garment of light in humanity, in a human that is standing at Tiferet and looking up. And that visionary is transformed in the process. And this transformation aspect for us is so important, because if you will not transform your pain, which this kind of meditation can do, if you won't transform it, you will transmit it, because it will go right down into Yesod and out into the world. Now, in this ascent, a great deal of information is given that's in Exodus, and he is given the entire design of the building of the temple, with all the aspects in it, including the menorah and the laver, which would be the trough for the water for cleansing, and the screen and the ark, everything that was in the temple and how it's built its very self. And he's told very clearly that it has to have curtains of blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen, which would be white or an off-white. And these are the colours that are put onto the Kabbalistic Jacob's ladder, reflecting the veil of the temple. So reflecting the way that this is a pathway into the Holy and Holies. And of course, somebody who's deeply experienced in Merkabah meditation, and no, we won't be doing one because it's far too dangerous. I have experienced one in a very, very safe group of people, and it was quite amazing, but I am not wise enough, authorized, or in any way capable of leading you in one, and anyway, I wouldn't, because you have to be present and do an awful lot of preparation work, about a week's worth of preparation work, before you would even consider that kind of ascent. However, I am sending you, I'm not going to do it right now because we don't have much time, but I am sending you tonight a sort of semi-demi-safe Merkabah meditation, which is a meditation to go inside your own version of the inner temple. It's an entirely safe meditation where you go inside your head and go into the temple in your mind and experience what you can of the levels within it. And people have been doing this particular version for years. It is entirely safe, and I will send it to you, and I hope you enjoy it. And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Next week we'll be looking at what happens after the Hebrews have been left on their own for 40 days and 40 nights with a new set of rules, and we know exactly what happens. They rebel. But we'll be talking about that next week. So let me stop the share and see if anybody's got any thoughts, comments and questions. Yes, Bill. Unmute, Bill.
You mentioned that one lovely midrash about God scolding the angels. There's another interesting midrash. I can't remember the name of the man concerned, but the midrash is about when Moses parted the Red Sea. It didn't part at once. It parted when one man had the faith to jump into the waters, and then the waters parted for him because he had the faith to do it.
Yes. And that's a lovely example of everything we've been talking about tonight, isn't it? The commitment and the courage to take that step, not knowing what will happen. And one of the things about faith is that we tend to think that the opposite of faith is doubt, but it isn't. The opposite of faith is certainty. Faith always contains the lack of knowing what will happen. Faith is something that you commit to, trusting, and you have to commit to it with your last penny, and it will unravel in front of you. But you have to make that commitment. So that's a very valuable insight, Bill. Thank you.
One other question I'd like to ask, you mentioned Moses receiving the instructions of the building of the temple. Mm. Was it the temple at that stage, or was it the Mishkan?
Well, yes, it was the tabernacle. It was the moving one that they had in the desert. Yes, absolutely. But they did follow that as much as they could when they built the physical temple.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
And
thank you very much. That's brilliant.
Oh, thank you. There's all sorts of fun things in that too. In that there's skins of Tashash and Me'em, and modern Bibles tend to translate those as badgers, but previous incarnations translated them as unicorns. I love that. Okay, are you happy then, everybody? Any more thoughts and comments, or shall I see you next week? I will see you next week. Hi again, everybody. I just looked up the Miriam the prophet bit, and the word is Nebia, and it actually refers to somebody who is a singer, a person who sings of tales of glory and delight. And that could also be a sort of a prophet, but it's not the kind of prophet we think of as with Samuel. So, Samuel or Isaiah or any of the other great prophets of the Hebrew Testament. So that's what I meant to say earlier. Sorry about that. See you next week.